friends. Welcome back once again to What Page Are You On? It me, your co-host, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with...
It me, Alice Slater.
It is you, Alice Slater. Hello again.
Hello, once again, coming from our dream chambers.
Under a duvet. I'm under a proper duvet this time, because as both me and Alice observed, my audio was quite quiet last time. Substandard, some may say. So I'm hoping that being under a proper duvet rather than just like a blanket will give us the sound that we want.
We're still experimenting with the perfect setup.
It's a whole new world for us. We don't really know what we're doing. We're just babies, but thank you for continuing to listen. So today is our last episode of the cursed year 2020. Alice, you had a good idea for this one, didn't you?
Yeah, we're going to end with a bang. We took to our Instagram account, which is at whatpagepod, and we invited our friends and listeners to ask us questions. So we're just going to do a little Q&A, just shoot the shit, answer some of your burning questions. There's questions about books, there's questions about writing, there's questions about goss. Let's just, as they say on YouTube, let's just dive right in.
Let's just dive right in. We'll put a link down below.
So our first little question is a really nice one. We have, how are you ladies? Truly.
How are you, Alice?
Truly, you know what? I'm all right. It's been a funny old year. I'm like cruising on like fumes right now. I'm looking forward to finishing work and like kicking it.
Are you experiencing millennial burnout?
As they say.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. I feel like, you know, there's just been a lot of news, you know?
Many
like
things.
It's been a year of like heavy news and I'm tired. How are you, Bert, truly?
I am very good. But I think I'm like a very generally happy person. I think it's quite hard to beat me down.
You do have a very positive outlook.
Yeah, I feel like without being kind of naive, I think I do have a very positive outlook. Or rather, yeah, I don't get ground down too easily. Or maybe it's just that I have a lot of good shit going on in my life all the time because I am a privileged lady. But yeah, so I was made redundant this year, which was not ideal, but it has catapulted me into the world of self-employment, which is not something I would have done by choice, but I am really enjoying. So yeah, that's how I'm doing.
I mean, I feel like I have personally had a very good year, like professionally, but it's like swings and roundabouts, isn't it? Like there's been some good shit, but ultimately there is this cloud.
Yeah, I feel like everything is cloudy.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to 2020 ending for that reason. I feel like there's a vaccine now. We just have like the final like hump of winter to get over. And then hopefully things will start looking better.
I agree. Even though we don't have any books out in 2021, which is rude. No,
that is true.
If anything, it's discrimination.
Very, 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 very specific kind of discrimination.
Yeah. Anti-what-page bud.
Okay, so the first proper question is, what is your favourite book of all time?
That's a big one. That's a big one to kick off the book chat with.
That's a serious question.
So I have like a couple of answers, but because one is going to crop up later, as it always does.
I already know what fucking book that's going to be, but
yes,
carry
you
on.
Do. I'm going to go for my other favourite book of all time, which is What I Loved by Siri Hustvedt, which I reread. It's one of the only books that I do reread, you know, semi-regularly, which is about the life of a dude and just the people that he knows and loves and has lived with in his life, which is a very boring way of trying to sell it, but I think it is amazing. And it's such... very surprising and, yeah, got lots of stuff in it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's such a hard one to, like, do the hard sell on, because I think the less you know about it, the better.
I agree. So, yeah, if you're even vaguely curious, you know, if you listen to this pod and you like the kind of books that we like, take my word for it that you would like What I Loved by Siri Hustvedt, because I'm not going to try and hard sell it to you by explaining the plot too much. I think you should just read it. Alice, what's your favourite book of all time?
So I have like a top five and I find it really hard to split between them. But in the nature, you know, the spirit of the question is just one favourite book. So I've picked The Poison Tree by Erin Kelly.
Juicy.
Yeah, because it's juicy. It's a great story. I love the characters. I love the writing on a line level. I just think it exemplifies my taste, which is stuff that's dark. It's got toxic friendship in it. It's very 90s. It's just an all-round banger for me. And it's one of my favorite books to give people as well.
Yeah, in terms of like explaining what I like in books, or like what I find compelling about books, I think What I Love does a good job of that, in terms of, you know, I like things about romantic relationships, people having affairs, the art world, surprises. So yeah, I think we've both chosen things that make sense for the people that we are. The next question is, if you could only read one book for the rest of your life, what would it be? Which I perceive to be a slightly different question to what is your favorite book of all time.
Me too.
What's your answer?
Oh, I don't know. I've had like 24 hours to think about this and I'm really struggling. What did you pick?
I picked a little book you may have heard me mention before. Yeah, I chose The Crimson Petal and the White by Michelle Faber just because it's really long and it's really fun. So I think I would probably get a lot out of reading that and rereading that.
Oh, man, I didn't even know why I bothered asking you that one. No, but you know what? It's legit. We're not here to mock each other's choices. Only a little bit. Gentle ribbing.
A gentle ribbing.
Okay, so I guess I would probably pick, if it's like only one book for the rest of your life, man, I just feel like what's something that I believe would carry me through the rest of my 30s, my 40s, my 50s? Like, it's just such a big question.
That's why I went for something fun and long, because I don't think that long books that are fun, I don't think there's that many.
I mean, I'd probably end up picking Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier.
Because it's good.
Or maybe because it's good, yeah. Or maybe The Virgin Suicides by Geoffrey Eugenides.
Also banging.
I guess the reason why those two rather than The Poison Tree is because it's boring to answer the same book for both questions. And I don't know, I feel like the breadth of The Virgin Suicides, maybe that would sustain me for longer, you know?
Also creatively, I think you would draw stuff from that book for your own, you know, your creative practice.
Yeah, true. Oh, it's a hard one. We were also asked for a desert island book choice, which I took kind of to mean the same thing. But maybe if I was on a desert island, I'd want something more vibey. Like maybe Daphne du Maurier would be a terrible choice because it makes me think of like a windswept, chilly Cornwall. And maybe on a desert island, I just want to like kick back with
The Beach by Alex Garland.
Which was one of my favourite books for a very long time.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll discuss that one later, actually.
Next question.
What's the book you wish you'd written?
I chose Fingersmith by Sarah Waters.
Ooh, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, I just thought about it and I was like, I have to choose a book that in no world could I ever write. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so not in any genre that I write in or aspire to write in that I think bangs and contains some level of, like, genius that I could never, ever possess, no matter how hard I tried. So I chose Fingersmith, which is no spoilers, but, yeah, tricksy little historical fiction written in contemporary times. So in a way, you know, much like Crimson Petal and the White, I think I do quite like juicy, naughty, tricksy historical stuff, but that is written in the 21st century. That's my vibe.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's like my fave genre, but it tends to, that if I do like something that's set in the past, that tends to be the circumstances in which it's written.
Also, they're both Victorian.
Yes, and I would never say that I was like interested in the Victorian era, but I do find quite a lot of contemporary historical fiction set in the Victorian era quite stimulating and interesting. So maybe I do like the Victorian era without knowing it.
That makes me think that maybe you should read Slammerkin by Emma Donoghue.
But maybe I
haven't
should.
Read it in like 10 years, so I don't know if I can stand by that recommendation, but I went through a phase of reading a lot of historical fiction set in the Victorian era, and I recall really enjoying that one.
Interesting. Okay, well, I'll take that under advisement. But if you haven't read Fingersmith by Sarah Waters, do not read anything about it. Just go buy it, read it, and be delighted. But don't read any, do not Google it, do not, just just pay money for it and then read it. Wouldn't you
like,
agree?
Don't even look it up online. Just use your little Siri or your little Hey Google bullshit.
And say,
do a
order
verbal
me,
order.
Order it for me. Get it. So yeah, that's my answer. What do you wish you'd written?
Okay, so I struggled with this one as well for different reasons to the last question. I kind of struggle with it because I always think like, well, a book that I wish I'd written, for me, it means like something that I feel like if only I'd thought of it, I'd be capable of doing it. Like I interpret it the other way.
Yeah.
And then by kind of default, most of those books, there's a really solid reason why I would not have been able to write them. So after much soul searching, I ended up choosing The Woman in Black by Susan Hill. Because like, I just think it would be really cool to have written like the definitive ghost story of the 20th century. And I don't think it's mad to call it that.
No, yeah, completely, yeah.
So yeah, that's what I chose. I think it would suit me.
That's a great choice. It suits you better than me writing Fingersmith anyway.
I can totally see you. But I guess that like it exemplifies the difference in our approaches to the question. Because if I was going to pick something which I couldn't in 1,000 years have actually written, I'd probably pick The Secret History.
Yeah.
But I'm not smart enough to write The Secret History, so it would never have happened.
But you could definitely have written The Woman in Black.
Definitely. Yeah, 100%. I mean, I could, yeah, 100%. If only. No, but do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
obviously,
that's
that
your
it kind
world.
Of...
It operates in a world that, yeah, I see you.
Now I feel like I'm implying that I think I'm good enough to write The Woman in Black. And I do not.
Only because I did a light ribbing.
Oh, you've done a light ribbing and now I feel sensitive. Okay, next question.
So are there any authors you loved 10 years ago that you've grown out of?
Okay, so how old were you 10 years ago, first of all?
21.
Oh, you're so small.
I am a tiny baby. I was 21 years old. Picture the scene. The year is 2010. I'm 21 years old and I am living in Montreal. I have never really lived outside of London before. And there I am, living abroad for the first time. I am yet to meet my best friend, Beth John. She is just around the corner. She currently has swine flu.
What?
Beth is a survivor. Really? Yeah, she's a survivor of swine flu.
Oh my God.
You should ask her about it. But yeah, so that was my life 10 years ago. Not really. I don't think there's anything that I loved 10 years ago that I would now be like, no, I don't do that anymore. No. I mean, when I was in my undergraduate degree, so I did French at university, and I tended to not really read a lot outside of my degree because I was reading a lot of books for that, and I was reading a lot of French books. So, yeah, I don't really remember being a great reader in my undergraduate degree. Tell me more, Alice. What's your answer?
So I would have been 25. I would have been living in Norwich, studying creative writing. So reading a huge amount. But I think then, yeah, I feel like there's fucking loads of books. Like I was a big Bukowski fan. I read loads of Ernest Hemingway. I read loads of The Beats, obviously, notably not Jack Kerouac. So I feel like I would disabandon a lot of the authors that I was reading back then. But I'm glad that I had read them. You know, like, I think it's valuable to me in my own way, but I certainly wouldn't be revisiting many of those books. Just like a lot of hyper-masculine shit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like, no regrets about reading them, but not your vibe now.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, I think it's also because, you know, when studying writing, you get exposed to, like, a lot of, you know, you get exposed to a lot of stuff, but what I was reading for pleasure, I think I was still kind of filling in the gaps of like the canon, you know?
Yeah.
And that's just what I happen to be drawn towards. Yeah. So
I guess because I didn't do like English or creative writing in an academic setting, I didn't read a lot of the same stuff that you would have read I don't know.
But that's the thing. I also feel like I was definitely influenced by hanging out with a lot of male creative writing students. Not so much at UEA, but which was my class was mostly women, but beforehand in my undergrad. And they definitely influenced what I felt was good literature. And I don't feel the same way anymore.
Good. So the next question is, are there any authors that are banned from your shelves?
For me, no. But I think it depends if we take the question literally or not.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, because like, I was haven't... like, well, why would I... Yeah. I don't know.
I haven't purged my shelves of authors who I disagree with politically. Like, I haven't dumped my copy of We Need to Talk About Kevin. But I certainly, if I lent it to someone, I wouldn't rebuy it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and like, I have kind of, yeah, I'm similar in vibe to that. But I also, I don't know, I feel like when we talk about, like, guilty pleasures, we always think that it means, you know, people are asking it with the angle of, like, something that's cheesy. Whereas for me, like, there are, you know, there are things that I consume that by people that I know are not good people, and I do it anyway. So, you know, like, I really love a couple of John Boyne's books, but I find him absolutely abhorrent on Twitter. And yet he has written some very good books, notably A Ladder to the Sky and Our Hearts and Hearts Invisible Furies. So yeah, that would be like, he's not banned from my bookshelves, but I always, you know, I'm quite cautious about, like, I don't tend to talk about how much I like those books because I feel kind of gross about endorsing him.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? As I feel like one of the main reasons that I would get rid of books who by authors that I no longer endorse, it would be purely for space reasons. But I also do take a lot of pictures of my books in front of my bookshelves. I think it's a good backdrop. And I am careful about what I include. I don't want to
implicitly
embarrass myself. Yeah, really. Like, yeah. But, you know, like, as I just was talking about Charles Bukowski, that's a great example of someone whose work as a young writer I found really compelling. As I learned more about him as a person, I found his work less so. And then also, as I look back with a more adult lens, I recognize that his books actually endorse some shit that is appalling, that I'm not interested in reading. But I have still kept those books because I never know when I'm going to want to revisit them again for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I know that's kind of like hoarder-like behavior, but I don't know. If you have the space to have a library, sometimes you're going to have some shit in that library that is well-written, good, whatever, part of the canon. It doesn't necessarily mean that, I don't know, I'm waffling now.
It's complicated.
It's complicated. Next question. What worst book you've ever read? And the person who asked the question has volunteered their answer, which is I Love Dick.
Which is a book that I love, so they are wrong. I don't know. Yeah, I thought long and hard about this. And I don't really know. I don't have an answer yet.
The thing is, I feel like when I hate something, I might really rant about it, like down at the pub or through WhatsApp or whatever. I might even talk about it online if it's something that, like, I politically hated. But then also, it will just glide off my brain, like...
Yeah, I don't hang on to that stuff in the way that I hang on to, like, books that I want to recommend.
Like, I'm trying to think. I'm positive that I've used the word hateful to describe. Like, I must have read some really fatphobic stuff in my time that I would class as garbage, but I can't think what it is.
Yeah. Original question asker. I'm sorry that we have not come up with a better answer to that question.
Yeah, disappointing. Apologies.
We've let you down. So the worst book that you read in 2020, accompanied with a devil emoji.
Okay. I've decided that I'm going to answer this question honestly. Are you going to answer this question honestly before I expose myself?
Yeah, I have an answer.
Okay, you go first. Go on.
So I chose, I mean, it's hard because I have an answer, but it's not like the worst book in the whole world. I just feel like it's really indicative of like a publishing trend that I find really lazy. So I chose Expectation by Anna Hope.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm just really fed up of reading these kind of millennial white lady books that don't surprise me at all. I'm fed up of not being surprised by this kind of literary fiction, kind of joyless, takes itself very seriously. Not interested at all.
Interesting. Blair from Learn This Phrase said the exact same thing very recently, but about a different book. Just saying that, like, maybe the bubble is bursting on just white millennial fiction, which about that centers women, that doesn't really operate on a kind of deeper or more complex level than, I don't know, lifestyle almost. I don't know if that's a fair description because I haven't read the book.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know what she said that about. Yeah, I'm just really, I'm out. Like, I'm not so stupid that I'm buying books because they are for someone of my demographic. I need more than that. And I really found that just, I was just waiting to be surprised by something in it. And it never came. It was just always very surface level. Yeah, didn't care for it at all. Don't really get what anyone saw in it. Good luck to her, though.
Good luck to her, though. Oh, God, you kill me.
So I know what you're going to say for your answer. I enjoyed this book, but I'm very interested in you not liking this book.
Well, I have a very specific reason why I've picked it as my worst book. Because it's probably not the book that I've slagged off the most, necessarily. But I felt like it's maybe biggest disappointment is the best way to describe it. So I've chosen Earthlings by Sayaka Murata, author of Convenience Store Woman. And I've chosen it, I guess, because I don't necessarily feel like super chill talking about like worst books ever. So I've chosen this kind of like as a politically safe choice in some ways. The reason I was disappointed was just that I loved Convenience Store Woman so much. It kind of ticked all the boxes for me in terms of plot, voice, setting. I loved it. Earthlings, I found kind of pootled along until it went sort of so off-piste. It takes a really unexpected turn. And I think it's really interesting that your pick is a book that you said didn't surprise you. I think Earthlings is very surprising in lots of ways. It just left me cold. And I think I want to be moved more than
yeah,
that.
It's surprising in ways that are in some ways a bit incoherent.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I don't think it'd be fair to call it the worst book of 2020. And I also think the Granta team did an incredible job with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, they obviously, I think the marketing was aware of the fact that it could be quite Marmite-y. And like they did this influencer campaign where they got people to film themselves as they read the final page or final couple of pages, which I thought was really clever and smart and cool. So I have, you know, a lot of good feelings towards the book for that, but it wasn't for me.
Yeah. And I think that was like a trend that we experienced in 2020 was, second books that did not live up to the first book.
But interestingly, I think that Earthlings is actually the author's first book.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I might be wrong. I'm pretty sure that Convenience Store Woman was not actually her debut.
Interesting.
Which also explains a lot to me because I think Convenience Store Woman is much smoother and tighter and it just lands better for me, and that explains a lot.
So the next question was, and to balance it out, most underrated book in 2020 or in general? In general, I think, is too big a question. Did you go in general or did you go 2020?
No, I didn't go in general. I also find because the longer... I mean, actually, I could answer in general very easily. For me, the most underrated book is The Pink Hotel.
Pink Hotel. I knew you were going to say that. And
I'm actually currently listening to the audiobook at nighttime, and I tried... That's my new habit before sleep is I listen to an audiobook for like 15 minutes. And I love that book. I cannot recommend it enough. I've talked about it absolutely loads, so I won't go into it any further. But
I think tomorrow is my credit day, so maybe I'll treat myself to that.
It's wonderfully read as well. I'm really enjoying the actor's voice. So that's my general. And mainly the reason for that is because I feel like, and I've said this before, but the cover doesn't sell it quite right for me, and it disappeared quite quickly considering it was longlisted for the Women's Prize. Mm. So yeah, that would be my in general underrated. What's your specific 2020 underrated?
I chose White Negroes by Laura Michelle Jackson.
But that hasn't come out in the UK.
Oh yeah. Okay, well.
That's a cheat.
I don't have an answer then.
Well, talk about White Negroes anyway.
So White Negroes by Laura Michelle Jackson is an essay collection around cultural appropriation, or exclusively to do with the appropriation of blackness in art and culture. And it's just fascinating. And yeah, it hasn't come out here and I don't know if it will, but I would recommend buying a copy by any means necessary. I don't know what I'd choose if I'm not allowed to choose that because it didn't come out here.
Well, you're allowed to choose it, but I just think it's not really underrated if it's not been released.
Well, I mean, it didn't, even in America, it didn't pop off in the way that other nonfiction titles popped off.
Interesting.
Tell me yours.
Well, I've chosen one that might sound like a stupid answer, but I think my reasoning is legit. I've picked Boy Parts by Eliza Clark. And the reason for that is because I don't think that it was hyped enough outside of our very specific Twitter demographic. Like, it didn't get any reviews. Eliza Clark got a profile in The Guardian, but it wasn't in The Guardian's end of year list. It was in the Reader's Choice list, but not in their independent book recommendations list or in their books of the year list. So yeah, I feel like although it's popping off and doing really well, I still feel like it's actually underrated in the wider landscape of literature.
Yeah, because obviously there is that, you know, and maybe we can come to this in the next couple of questions time, but the difference between our world and the real world is enormous.
100%. 100%.
So no spoilers, but so we'll come to that. But the next question was, what's the most overrated book you've ever read? I'm a messy bitch. Alice, what was your choice?
Okay, so I just absolutely loved this question with the caveat of I'm a messy bitch. I think overrated is a really hard thing to quantify, to be perfectly honest. And like, I struggle a little bit with picking a book that I know is very beloved by other people and saying, you know what I mean? Like, I expected to love it because everyone loves it so much, and I didn't because I'm so special and smart. Mm. Like, it's not really my vibe. I do have a title that I feel like I can think of two books that I think were very beloved by everyone on Twitter, which I actually didn't rate at all, but I feel too cunty naming them.
Okay, well, I'll name one instead.
Go on.
I actually chose Girl on the Train by Paula
that
Hawkins.
That is such a good answer. Your brain.
My mind.
Yeah, fuck.
Just because it's... The book itself is a fine book. It is just any book. And somehow, maybe it was just some like lowest common denominator shit, but it managed to capture people in a way that was so disproportionate to the content of the book that I'm like, my mind boggles to this day.
That is just such a good answer because it was unprecedented. Like, it changed the standard hardback price of thrillers. It had a special edition hardback with like a foiled cover, and it's just a good but average page-turner thriller.
There is nothing that separates that book from any other thriller. And as we've learnt this year, things being unprecedented does not always mean they're good.
True. I think also, though, it just had such a compelling, nutshelled, like, elevator pitch description, which I couldn't even tell you what it was now, but I remember saying it like 1,000 times a day when I was a bookseller. And I think that that's what did it. It's a combo of it being affordable comparatively, because most hardbacks tend to be closer to £20. That one was £12.99 full price. It was just a little bit cheaper, and it stayed in hardback for 18 months.
Mad.
Like, that is completely wild. God, that's such a good answer. I wish I thought of that.
Well, I'm just so smart. It almost defies belief. Next question.
So the next one is, do you think books can be so overhyped in advance that people lose interest?
Yeah, so I think this is where our convo about like our world versus the real world is quite relevant, because what we experience online is so different to the way that most people operate in real life, especially in regards to books. So like, things that we hear about every day might not even have registered with like your average person going into Waterstones. So I don't know. Like, so yeah, I do think books can be so overhyped in advance that like some random gals on the internet lose interest. But I don't think in the long term that is going to have any impact on the book success.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like, I think when I think about books that where the proofs come out super early and the hype train leaves the station really far in advance, I know that that can be frustrating for people who don't have access to proof copies, who aren't in the book world in that way. But I mean, that's just how big campaigns work. And, you know, I don't think that people hype stuff up for the sake of it. I think where some people see hype, I see passion and enthusiasm. And I don't think that you can fake that. I don't think it's people intentionally trying to show off and flex. I mean, some people, sometimes it is, but, you know, I don't think it's just about trying to show off about being in a, you know, the special club that gets proof copies. Like, it's comes with the territory if that's what you do for a living or for your, you know, your passion.
And so, also, yeah, it represents a book that, you know, if you're hearing a lot about a book before the book's come out, that means the publisher must have paid an awful lot of money for it, and they're not going to let it fail. So you hearing loads about it just means that it's probably being guaranteed to succeed by virtue of all the marketing. So yeah, if anything, people will, this is not going to be a book that people will lose interest in.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, I can think of, like, maybe, I think there's one book, I think Luster from Picador is the one, and then also maybe The Other Black Girl from Bloomsbury. They're like two books that I think have already started causing, like, there's a lot of energy for them online. But I think it's exciting. I'm not going to go. And, like, also, you know, they're not necessarily books. There's one of those two I've read, and Luster I have a copy of. The other one I haven't. I'm not going to get sick of it. I'm just going to get thirstier and thirstier until I'm absolutely fucking parched.
Yeah.
And then I will take delight in buying it and reading it.
So yeah, I think it's quite a, like, Twitter specific concept that does not necessarily exist outside of that. That's, yeah, my answer. Agreed. So what's a book that we have emphatically different opinions on?
I can think of two.
I just went for The Thrillers of Steve Kavanagh.
Oh, yeah, shit, that's a good point.
Because I enjoy them and you do not.
Yeah, they're just a bit butch for me.
Yeah, whereas we know that I like macho dude shit.
Yeah, and speaking of macho dude shit, the one that I thought of was Lock Every Door by Riley Sager.
Did I like that?
Did you like that?
It was fine.
Oh, okay. I just thought it fucking stank. I hated it. Who was it that recommended it then?
I didn't recommend it. I mean, I read it, but I wasn't like, maybe I read it and said that it was, you know, fun enough to get me out of my reading funk. But
what is your other choice?
Okay, so the other one I had was I Love Dick, the aforementioned.
Yeah, I love that. And I stand by it.
I didn't like it. Sorry, yeah, my bracelets are going now. Hang on. There we go. I didn't like it. What did you think?
I love it. I know it's a very Marmite-y book, but I just love it. I think if I'm going to be reading about, like, women doing things, I want to be reading about, like, women doing surprising, weird, and daring things. And, yeah.
Which, you know, you describe it like that and it sounds great. I think it just sounds so great on paper, but in reality, it was much more literary.
Yeah.
Than my preference is. I think it was just not quite as compelling on a line level.
Yeah, it has a lot of other stuff going on in addition to that. That's the other thing, is that there's, like, it is quite theory and it has, like, art and, yeah, there's things about it that I totally get why people don't like it. I'm not in any way defensive of it if other people don't like it, but for me, it just really, yeah, it strikes a lot of the things that I'm interested in.
And also, I feel like it was one that everyone read at the same time, so there was quite a lot of hype around it.
Yeah, it was reissued. Yeah, in the last few years. Yeah,
it left me a little disappointed.
Yeah, I understand that.
But that's the only one. Otherwise, I think generally we're pretty much on the same page.
Pardon the pun. So the next question was, I'd love to hear the very specific irrational things that instantly fascinate or disinterest you with a book. I struggled to answer this one.
Did you?
Yes.
Interesting. I did not.
Tell me yours. Maybe you won't inspire me.
I guess the only thing I would say is that I don't think these are irrational. I think that I could explain exactly why I'm into all these things. So fascinate. I'm always going to be drawn to disenfranchised 20-somethings. I'm always going to be drawn to missing teenage girls. Mm. New Orleans, serial killers, characters who are living on the margins, toxic obsessive friendships, toxic obsessive romantic relationships, sexual awakenings, alcoholism, drug addiction, hedonism, anything that's in that bracket I'm going to enjoy. In terms of things that are going to turn me off something, and again, like, I know the question is irrational, but I just was vibing. I'm not interested in narratives about fatness and appetite that are written by thin people. I just have no interest in that. Anything that's too girl bossy, girly SWAT, head girl, feminism, all that shit. No thanks, not interested. And then also, like, I think we could vibe forever on this, but as an example, that kind of book club fiction that's like job title plus sad place, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like The Cobbler of the Titanic, anything like that, I'm just...
I'm out.
I don't know, it's just not going to do it for me.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, I don't know. I would agree with that characterization of that genre of books as being a turn-off for me. But in general, yeah, like, although I agree with everything you've just said, I'm sure that I can think of things where something that I thought I'd like, I didn't like, even though it kind of... You know, I don't know. I'm quite open to being surprised and delighted.
What about your instantly fascinate list? Because some of mine are very specific, like New Orleans.
Yeah.
What about you? What would immediately would you make you look twice?
Yeah, even as you were saying that, I was like, I don't think I have those specific turn-ons in the same way. Because even things that, you know, we've already established in this episode alone that I like good, naughty, contemporary fiction set in the Victorian period, but that is in itself is not enough to make me read a book. I won't be sufficiently curious about something on that basis alone. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. But then I suppose, like, yeah, I mean, I'm not automatically going to pick up everything that features alcoholism, but, like...
When you read it, that turns you on.
Yeah, like, it's not a turn-on, but it's something that, just thinking about what a lot of my favourite books have in common.
Yeah.
That's something that I'm drawn to.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that maybe the books that I like are quite... Like, if you looked at my kind of top five, I think they're all quite different in terms of, like, content and execution and style. I think my taste is less coherent than yours, in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair play.
I'll contemplate, because there must be things. I like art, but I, again... that's more like a thing that if it turns up, I'm like, oh, nice. And if it's executed well, I'm into it. But yeah, apart from that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose like this little list, I'm thinking more if I'm browsing in a bookshop, keywords on the back of the book that will make my ears prick rather than books that I specifically seek out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like with the disinterested list, like that could literally go on forever. Yeah. I'm not going to read anything from the mind, body and spirit section. I'm not going to read anything from the business section. Like, you know, that could just go on forever. But then I was just thinking, like, you know, having a bit of fun with it.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I just literally couldn't come up with anything. I don't know why when I was reading this, I was just like, I have no idea what I would say to this question. But you answered it perfectly. This is like your girl on the train answer.
Fair play. Okay, so the next one, tips for people struggling with reading during the pandemic, or a book to rekindle the fire.
Yeah, for me, whenever I'm on like a reading slump, I will just go on my Kindle and find a random thriller that my dad has bought on our shared Kindle account. And I will just read any thriller, because if I need something to kickstart me reading again, it will have to be something where the plot in itself is propelling me onwards and compelling me to read. So I would always just read any thriller, even if in the end it's unsatisfying. The experience of reading it will have forced me to read and read quickly, because I love intrigue.
Yeah, that makes sense. I certainly said I feel like a book to rekindle that flame is so personal and specific. I find it hard to recommend a single thing, but I would say either something super short, if you're going to struggle to get absorbed and finish something, or alternatively super long if you need the habit, if you need something that's habit building. Or for me, it will always be books that are really voice driven. So something like The Perks of Being a Wallflower, Boy Parts, Convenience Store Woman, these all have very different voices, but that's what would suck me in.
Interesting. Yeah, in I terms... would never I'd never think to recommend like a long book to get you reading it again, because I think part of the satisfaction is having read it. So I'd almost be like, as much as in the same way as recommending a thriller, I'd be tempted to go for a short book so you have the satisfaction of having read it.
And then in terms of like tips, I think for me it's that you have to set time aside You know what I mean? Like, you have to say to yourself, I'm going to read for half an hour.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to read 30 pages, 20 pages, whatever. Or alternatively, trying a different form. So if you normally read paperbacks, try an audiobook or try a Kindle.
Yeah.
Try something different and work to develop a routine from there.
So the next question was, Wolf Hall has had a lot of hype, but I'm struggling to get into it. Should I keep going? I want a chunky novel to get into. Alice, have you read Wolf Hall?
I have not. Have you?
Okay. Here is my Wolf Hall story. So, something we have established in the previous many episodes of this beloved pod is that I like to use my Audible credits on the longest things possible. Obviously, Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel very much falls into that category. So, I bought Wolf Hall and it's about 24 hours long, which is my dream. I have listened to about 8 hours of it, which is way too much for me to listen to it again. But also, if I was going to keep listening to it, I wouldn't know what was happening because I did this about 2 years ago. So I think...
That's a terrible position to be in.
I have literally fucked myself so badly. I think Wolf Hall has to be dead to me. I think I have to write it off and just accept that it's never going to happen. I wasn't enjoying... You know, look, put it this way. If I was loving it, I would have kept listening to it, but I didn't. Because unlike reading with my eyes, I tend to... like, if I'm reading a book and then I have to stop reading it because I need to read something for an event or for the podcast, that I will probably pick that book up again sometime. Whereas with audiobooks... For me, it's quite a, like, low-effort thing. So if I'm gonna... I could just keep listening to it. And if I'm choosing not to, there's a reason for it.
I think that's legit. I think if you're struggling to get into something, like, you can only read a book for the first time once. And, like, that's a fucking chunky book. If you're not into it... I mean, they haven't said how far that in they are. But if you're the equivalent of 8 hours in...
That's like a quarter, or like, yeah. No, a third of the way through. I'm a third of the way through, and yeah, I'm out. So that's my answer. But I'm happy that like such a chunky and kind of challenging story is so popular.
I think for our question asker, if you want a chunky novel to get into, then read The Crimson Petal and the White.
Yeah, which is the answer Perfect. To my next question. Which was, what's the ultimate betwixtmas read? Because I gave this answer on the episode that we recorded about... It was the Christmas shopping episode that we did. So if you haven't listened to that, listen to that ep. You asked this question in the books on our kind of Christmas gift list episode. And I said Crimson Petal and the White, just because it's long. And if you're not going to make the effort to read it in other times of your life, maybe this is the time. Also, it's really juicy and really fun. And... Yeah, very kind of lamp-lit, cobbled street, so quite cozy. What's your choice?
Well, I just kind of did the same sort of mental vibe. I was just thinking I would go with a Chunky Monkey. I'd go with something that I've always wanted to read but I've never got around to. But then for me, that's very specifically because I always do a like books of the year list, either for the pod, on Instagram, or Twitter. So by the time I hit Betwixtmas, I already will have posted that. So I consider it like a free-for-all time where I'll just, you know, vibe and read whatever. If I could delete a book from my brain and then reread it this Christmas, it would be The Secret History, which I know is a bit of a boring answer in some ways, but...
There are people out there that haven't read it. Like, yeah, they do exist. So we may
capture
some...
Pick me something...
Yeah.
Yeah, pick me something juicier than that, man. Like, you won't.
You can't. It can't be done.
Exactly. So yeah, a little bit boring, but I would pick that and that's my reasoning. So if anyone knows of another book which is as long and as iconic and as gripping as The Secret History, LMK.
But you won't, so that's fine. Ooh, so the next question was, I always love your psychological thriller recs. Any bangers for the holidays a la Erin Kelly and Sarah Stovall? Alice, did you have a... I'm sure you had a pick that you could recommend.
Yeah, I have two. That I'm positive I've already discussed at some point this year on the pod, but the two best thrillers that I've read this year were Magpie Lane by Lucy Atkins and The Turn of the Key by Ruth Ware.
Hmm.
They're both very similar. They're both about nannies. They're both set in, one is set in a really fancy house in the Highlands. The other is set in Oxford. Super gripping. They're also really chunky as well. So they would also be quite good betwixt miss reads if you prefer your holiday reading to be a bit more lighthearted. Yeah, really gripping. Love them.
Cool. Okay, so I chose an all-time fave that did not come out this year. So a polls if you're wanting something very new, but I went to 2015 and I chose Disclaimer by Renee Knight, which is so good. And I would happily reread, actually, because I think it is a great book as well as a great thriller, because sometimes those two do not coexist. So the plot, as I have copied and pasted from the publisher's website so that I do not mess it up, is: when an intriguing novel appears on Catherine's bedside table, she curls up and begins to read. But as she turns the pages, she is horrified to realize she is a key character, a main player. This story will reveal her darkest secret, a secret that she thought no one else knew. So basically, it's about reading a thriller and finding that you are the main character.
Juicy as fuck.
Yeah.
And like, why wasn't that as big as The Girl on the Train?
Because people are stupid.
But do you know what I mean? In terms of, like, kind hook, of wild yeah. hook, you know, that's pretty wild.
There's and no reason why not. I don't know.
Yeah. When you said that you had picked something that was pre-2020, I was so sure you were going to go with a Megan Abbott.
Yeah, I was thinking Megan Abbott, but then I just thought, no, I haven't talked about this for a while. So I'm going to say Disclaimer by Renee Knight.
Love it. Publishing trends of 2021.
You're better at this than me.
Okay, thank you, first of all. Secondly, so I kind of made some notes as, like, just stuff that I feel is fairly obvious but may not be obvious if you're not, like, obsessed with tracking what the publishing industry is doing. I obviously think that we're going to see an inevitable spike in debuts from Black authors. I don't want that to be a trend. I want that to be, like, a precedent that will continue forever, but I think that's inevitable right now. And also, I'm optimistic in seeing more books from trans authors in the UK this year, particularly fiction.
Yeah, that would be nice.
But yeah, I think there's at least 3 or 4 books by trans authors, both fiction and nonfiction, coming out next year, which I'm quite excited about. In terms of content, though, I think we're going to see more... I've kind of described them as sort your life out books, but, you know, more like on a practical level, like the Mrs. Hinch, the Marie Kondo-esque stuff.
Yes.
Which I know that's not necessarily fresh, but because we've all been stuck at home, I just think that we're going to see, like, renewed interest in organization, like making the most of smaller spaces, that kind of thing.
Interesting. Yeah, I think you could be right, my friend.
But yeah, that's all I really have at the minute. I don't know. I was convinced for ages that we would see... in much like I was convinced that Moss was going to be like the houseplant of 2020, which I feel it was not. I've spent a long time thinking that we would start seeing more emotionally poignant memoirs that involve environmentalism in one way or another.
Hmm.
You know, like H is for Hawk, but maybe somehow about plastics. I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been like waiting for, but it still hasn't come.
Well, maybe 2021 is the year. Okay, so then predicted bangers for next year. We kind of covered that in a whole episode. So I would recommend that the person who asked this question listens to that, because we did this. But there was one book that we didn't mention that I was like, what's wrong with me? The new Elizabeth McNeil.
Der.
Exactly.
I can't believe you forgot that. Is it out next year?
It's out next year. She's just finished doing the... I think she's finished editing it, so it is on its way. The title has not been announced, and I think that's probably why we left it off, is more that it's just, like, a thing that we know is in the works because we know her, but it doesn't have, like, a cover announced, it doesn't have all of this stuff announced, so maybe it wasn't, like, on the radar. I think it's out in the first half of the year, so would have been in that ep, but maybe not. Either way, in 2021...
surely not.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong. Well... in 2021, anyway. I'm looking forward to reading the new book by Elizabeth McNeil whenever that comes out, because I love The Doll Factory. Do you know what The Doll Factory is? It's a contemporary novel set in the Victorian era.
Yeah, I feel like now that you mention it, this would have been a good opportunity to cover at least one or two of the titles that I realized after we recorded our 2021 app that I'd forgotten about. But unfortunately, I didn't prepare to do that, so I have nothing.
Cool.
Good. Okay,
so I'm going to ask you the next question because I know you have an answer for this. Any books by disabled writers that you're anticipating next year, either fiction or nonfiction?
So I did struggle a little bit with this one. I know that there's a book from Influx that we didn't discuss in the 2021 episode called In the Shadow of the Phosphorus Dawn, which is by an author called Rob True, and it's psychedelic horror. But he's a working class author, he's schizophrenic, and he only learned to read and write in his 40s. So he sounds really interesting, and I'm really excited to read his book and to see what it's like. But that's actually it. That's the only book I have that I can think of that I'm like anticipating earnestly, which is by a disabled writer. So if anyone's listening to this and they have some recommendations, I know that Jen Campbell has just filed something, but I'm not sure if it's 2021 or 2022. But yeah, so if there's anything that you think would fit in with the kind of books that we love, which is by a disabled author, please let us know. I'd love to know what I'm missing out on.
Agree. Next cue.
What's your take on Diving Bell's response to the Flo Given Chidera of Sunflower fame situation?
Well, yeah, this has been a mess, hasn't it? This has been like a little internet mess.
What a time.
Yeah, so basically, so for anyone that does not spend as much of their time on the internet as we do, this situation concerns two young ladies. So the first person of these two to release a book was Chidera, aka the Slumflower. She had a book out in like 2018 called What a Time to Be Alone. And then this year, a white influencer called Florence Given had a book out called Women Don't Owe You Pretty. And visually they are quite similar, and the content is also quite similar. Neither of them are like particularly probing feminist texts. They're just very like entry level. So on that vibe, I'm not like rooting for either of them in terms of the content, but it is a very interesting example of the way that like black women's work gets cannibalized and repackaged and put out by white women in no time at all. Potentially for more money, I don't know. I don't know the specifics of like the two of their book deals. But the Diving Bell, as referenced in the question, is a talent agency that represented both of them and dropped Chidera when she started talking publicly and very critically about the similarities between her book and Florence Given's book. So my opinion on that is that I just think that it shows how disposable black female talent is and how easy it is for them to get dropped with little thought to the consequences about the context and their circumstances and then their ability to make money. It reminds me a lot of what happened to Stephanie Yeboah earlier this year when she was dropped by Grazia as a columnist. I think she was treated much more roughly than a white woman would have been in the same situation. So yeah, I just think it's very like, it shows how surface level a lot of these media companies' understanding of like racial dynamics is if they think that abandoning black women is the right thing to do and preventing them from being able to make money. That's my answer. So that was very long, but that's my answer.
I think that's a good take. I'd also say that Gal Dem have published a really good piece about the whole situation. If anyone listening would like to learn more about it from ladies who are not white.
Oh yeah, so was that by Moya Lothian McLean?
I think that was who wrote it, but yes.
So that's been very popular. So if you want to read it from someone who isn't me, read Moya's article on Gal Dem. So the next question was, juicy book world gossip.
Like, yes, please. Just send it all to us.
Yeah.
I assume that's an offer rather than a request.
I hope so. We have a lot of juicy book world gossip and we get it from various sources and I love it all.
I was trying to think like what's a known thing that we could say is like our favourite piece of goss, like our favourite dinner party thing to reveal.
Well, and I don't know.
I have
okay, you tell me.
My favourite thing to tell people is that the man who ghostwrote the Motley Crue book, The Dirt, also ghostwrote the Marilyn Manson biography called The Long Road Straight Out of Hell. And he is also the author of The Game.
The pickup artist.
Yeah, he did that whole thing. His name's Neil Strauss. And I just think that's an interesting little nugget.
That is a nugget. I have no such nuggets that I feel able to share.
That's all we have to say on that.
We love any goss. So if you ever hear anything and you would like to tell someone, just DM us. We would like to know. Because we've got our sources, namely, well, you know who. But we need more sources.
Yeah, never be shy.
Never be shy.
What are you both writing next?
Well, I have not announced my next thing, so I cannot tell you.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I have a thing that is on the horizon, but it has not been announced yet. And that's just one of the weird little technicalities of publishing is that, you know, until the publisher, whoever they are, and the project, whatever it is, has been officially announced, I can't really talk about it publicly. But I am very into it. I'm really happy about it. I love this book and what it will lead to next. And I think people who have liked my other books will also be delighted by it. That is my what I'm saying at the moment.
Full of secrets.
I'm full of secrets. But yeah, I don't know when it will be announced. I don't know how far out that announcement will be. But yeah, publishing is like a strange old thing. Like with my first book, No Big Deal, I wrote that in like the summer of 2016. I got an agent at the end of 2016. And in January 2017, I sold it to Macmillan, my publisher. And then it wasn't announced until like 6 months later. And then it didn't come out for another 2 years. There are like, you know, I think maybe that's something that people who are not published and do not work in publishing do not know, that there are just these enormous gaps between like a thing being done, like the deal being sealed, and anyone really knowing about it. And then between that and the book coming out. So yeah, we've got a little wait, but hopefully you will hear about it soon. Alice, what are you writing?
So I am writing, I'm going to keep my cards quite close to my chest for similar reasons, although I haven't sold my book yet because it's not finished. But I'm writing something, it's fiction about true crime and bookselling.
That's I can't all wait.
I'm going to say, and I'm only, I feel like the other thing with describing a project that you're currently working on is that you can take the air out of it by describing it too often.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like you can get a little bit too comfortable with the premise, and yeah. So it's partly out of superstition, partly just out of being cautious about, you know, my own attitude towards my work. I'm going to keep it kind of on the DL, but yeah, it's about true crime and bookselling, and I'm really enjoying writing it.
It's going to bang, so I can't wait to read it.
Cheers, pal.
Yeah.
I'm actually like in the thick of it right now because I'm trying to finish. I've written a first draft, which is just, it's quite skeletal. I'm now trying to finish what will eventually be a second draft by like mid-January. So it's pretty stressful.
I believe in you.
Cheers, bub.
But yeah, we'll do an episode about like how we write one day and like what we write and whatever. But yeah, I think we are quite different beasts. So I think it would be an interesting conversation. But yeah, we're now on the final question. And that is, how do you know when the first draft is done? Mine is V terrible, says the question. Alice, how do you know?
Well, it depends on what you're writing. So I feel like for a short story, for anything, the first draft is done when you have a beginning, middle, and end. That's it. I think everything subsequently is a subsequent draft. So don't worry about your first draft. It's meant to be terrible. As long as you have everything that's meant to happen down on the page, pretty much in one way or another, call it a first draft. Fuck it. I don't think there's anything more to it than that. How would you describe a first draft? When do you know that it's finished?
Yeah, so I also think that when is a first draft finished changes quite a lot once you have an agent, because once I have written, like now that I have written a first draft, essentially, I know that there is someone that can then look at it for me, whose job it is to know about selling books, who can then advise me on how to make it better or more commercial. But I think I would find this question much harder to answer if it was like a purely creative question, whereas for me it's a commercial question. Yeah, if I didn't have an agent, I think I wouldn't know when I was done. But because I do, I just write, I go through it, I write chronologically, so I start at the beginning and I know what's going to happen in every chapter until I get to the end. And then when I get to the end, I have finished to the best of my ability at that moment in time to write the book. And I will go back and reread it, but I don't tend to change that much because nothing has really changed since I wrote it and I need another pair of eyes to look at it. And so that's why I do like having someone whose job it is to make it better with me. But yeah, I do not know how to answer this question in a way that is productive to someone who is asking it from a creative point of view.
Well, I just feel like that the question is in itself, it contains like a slight flaw. I think that if you're talking about how do you know when a first draft is finished, you're overthinking the role of a first draft.
Yeah.
Creatively. Like your first draft is just the throwing down of the clay. Yeah. Like you get to the end and that's it. If you're already rewriting a first draft before you have got to the end, as tempting as that can be, you are going to be creating more work for yourself. You need to get to the end of it. And that literally means one foot in front of the other, walk the whole distance, get to the end. You can then go back through it to flesh it out, edit it, change things, whatever you need to do. But yeah, philosophically, a first draft is done when you have written the last full stop.
Well, yeah, when everything you intended to be in the book is in the book, like when every part of the plot that you envisaged before you started writing it, when you've included all of those elements, and then that's kind of there, I guess.
Exactly. Whereas the question of when is it ready to like be sent out, when is it the final version of your like initial draft rather than first draft, that's more complicated. And I feel like it's when you have reached a point that you're satisfied that your vision and the reality of what's on the page is as close as you can get. And they will never truly align, but it's when you feel like you have reached maximum, I don't know, like maximum patience with it, I guess. But it's hard. Yes. And like for short stories, I feel like a short story is finished when it has a home and you can no longer touch it. Or when you've truly outgrown it and you don't want to change it anymore.
Yeah, it's hard. And I do feel very glad that I have someone whose job it is to like help me do this stuff. So yeah, I'm sorry that I could not give a better answer.
No, but I still feel like that's a valid answer because we don't know the person asking the question. You know, we don't actually know what the situation is. So it's two different answers for two different types of writer at different stages in their career.
True, true, true. Well, that was the last question.
We've been recording for a really long time.
This is like our longest episode for ages. This is like longer than even our old episodes. But you know,
there was quite a lot of fanning around in the middle when we discovered our laptops were overheating. So maybe once that's been cut out, it'll be more normal in length.
True.
But what fun! 2020. And also,
you know, we are coming back in 2021, but because you have a lot of writing to do, we're going to take it a little bit slower at the beginning of the year. So we'll be back like, you know, late Jan, early Feb. So this gives people a lot of material to carry them through the winter without us.
That is true. And then maybe we can come back with an episode more about writing than reading.
Yes. Maybe by then people will know what my book is, but maybe not. Who knows?
All right. Well, let's call it a day.
I need to eat a sweetie. I'm so hungry. Well, we'll see you next time. Enjoy your festive breaks of all denominations, or whether you have one or not. Have a nice December, rest of December and New Year. We hope that 2021 is juicy, and we will see you soon.
Catch you later. Bye.